A knock at the door announced the arrival of the waiter with the flutes. Feathers irritably gestured him to be silent.
Though the night be made for loving, and the day return too soon, yet will go no more a-roving by the light of the moon.
Then came the rushing roar of water let out of the bath.
She doesn't understand the words, repeated Feathers.
Her face was wet with tears. When he saw that, Walser felt an extraordinary sensation within his breast. His heart dissolved. He reached out his hand towards the woman and sparked off a sharp pain in his mauled shoulder, exclaimed, discovered he too was crying. She looked towards him, her night-dark eyes brimming, and for once there was no irony, malice, or suspicion within them. His molten heart spilled out of his bosom and flowed towards her, just as one drop of mercury flows towards another drop of mercury. At that moment, Mignon came back through the bathroom door. She was wrapped up in a spotless, fleecy toweling robe, and her freshly washed hair was bundled in a white towel. Now she was sparkling clean and wreathed in smiles, though greenish with bruises. She still clutched the drum of chocolates under her arm, but all that was left of the top layer was a mass of chirruping papers. She looked a mite aggrieved when Feathers, after blowing her nose rather disgustingly between her fingers, served her a nursery bowl of bread and milk, but she perked up when she saw the champagne, sat down at the table with lamb-like obedience, and tucked in willingly enough. Feathers now held a rapid communication with the waiter, at the conclusion of which she reached in her reticule for another complimentary ticket to opening night, and must have already learned enough Russian to make jokes, for the man abruptly guffawed before he bowed out again. Lizzie was already ripping the foil on the bottle. Feathers clinked glasses all round. Her eyes were quite dry now, and had turned strangely pale. There was a hard, bright, dangerous quality to her suddenly.
"We'll make an honest whore of her yet," she toasted her visitor, in a voice that rasped like the tongue of a tiger, and Walser, with nervous glee, perceived that she believed Mignon to be his mistress, and was, heaven be praised, consumed with jealousy.
Feathers drained her glass in a gulp, belched, and tossed it into a corner, where it smashed. This gesture seemed more a display of temper than one in accordance with the custom of the country.
"Come here," she ordered Walser peremptorily. "Liz, the cold cream." "Kneel, Mr. Walser."
Prepared for anything, Walser knelt at her feet, to find himself firmly grasped between thighs accustomed to gripping hold of the trapeze. He suffered a sudden access of erotic vertigo, and attempted to engage her eyes in another exchange, but she looked steadfastly away from him as she ripped off his wig and ruffled up his flattened blonde hair with a large nurse's hand, competent, impersonal, tetchy. Then she smothered him in cold cream.
"Make you pretty," she said.
When he tried to speak, she stuffed a handful of cold cream in his mouth. She seized a napkin from the trolley and scrubbed his matte white off with such vigour he emerged brick red and polished like a floor. Mignon, already giggling with champagne, was helping herself to seconds of bread and milk. Lizzie, for some reason tense with disapproval, abstracted herself from this scene, drew some pamphlet or other from her bag, and immersed herself in it. Feathers straightened Walter's tie and eyed his costume with displeasure.
"God, the poor girl. Out of the monkey house into Clown Alley. Talk about the frying pan and the fire. Didn't you know how I hate clowns, young man? I truly think they are a crime against humanity."
The waiter now returned and stood expectantly by the door. Lizzie turned a page with a rustle of crisp disaffection. Mignon, having finished her supper, looked round with curiosity to see what would happen next.
"Well, get on with it," said Feathers. "Up on your feet and sweep her off hers. I've booked you the bridal suite, haven't I?"
The tittering waiter bowed and opened the door. Walser rose to his feet with as much dignity as he could muster, cracked Feathers his whitest grin, and offered Mignon his good arm with a show of old-fashioned courtesy
that made the giantess drum her fingers on the arm of her chair. Mignon ducked back to pick up the box of chocolates she had almost forgotten in this sudden turn of events, a dithering trail of paper wrappers scattered behind their exit. As they left the two women alone, Lizzie flung aside her paper and announced mirthlessly, "Laugh. You'll be the death of me." In the bridal suite, a predictable nest of rosy satin and gilded mirrors, the waiter drew Mignon's attention with a lordly wave to a stiff, scentless bouquet of florist's red roses by the bed, obviously a special touch ordered by Feathers, then beaming, chortling even, he withdrew. Walter's first, deplorable impulse was to throw himself on the poor child and force her to teach somebody or other, he was not quite sure whom, a lesson. But he was a fair man, and the fierce pain in his wounded arm when he seized Mignon by the shoulder reminded him it would be unjust, so he let her be. If Mignon's day had started badly, it was ending well. It was ending like a girlish dream come true, in fact, especially when Walser backed off. And she could not get over those roses. She cooed to them, caressed them, made soft, loving passes at them, hovered and purred around them with such heartbreaking, unknowing grace that Walser, by no means an insensitive man, let out an almost sob of touched perplexity. "Oh, Mignon, what am I to do with you?" To be addressed directly in the English language struck some chord in that peculiar and selective organ, her memory. She pulled the towel off her head, and her Gretchen yellow hair sprayed out in all directions. She smiled. This smile contained her entire history, and was scarcely to be borne. "God save the Queen," she said. Walser could stand no more, and rushed from the room. Chapter 6. Two things so far have conspired together to throw Walser off his equilibrium. One, his right arm is injured, and although healing well, he cannot write or type until it is better, so he is deprived of his profession. Therefore, for the moment, his disguise disguises nothing. He is no longer a journalist masquerading as a clown. Willy-nilly, force of circumstance has turned him into a real clown, for all practical purposes, and what's more, a clown with his arm in a sling, type of the wounded warrior clown. Two, he has fallen in love, a condition that causes him anxiety, because he has not experienced it before. Hitherto, conquests came easily and were disregarded. But no woman ever tried to humiliate him before, to his knowledge, and Feather has both tried and succeeded. This has set up a conflict between his own hitherto impregnable sense of self-esteem and the lack of esteem with which the woman treats him. He suffers a sense, not so much that she and her companion have duped him. He remains convinced they are confidence tricksters, so that would be no more than part of the story, but that he has been made their dupe. In a state of mental tumult, conflict and disorientation, he wanders the freezing city night, now gazing at the ice thickening on the dark waters of the Neva, now peering at the great horseman on his plinth with a vague terror, as though the horseman were not the effigy of the city's founder, but the herald of four yet more mythic horsemen, who are, indeed, on their way to confound Petersburg forever, though they won't arrive yet. Not quite yet. Chapter 7. Brisk, bright, wintry morning, under a sky that mimics a bell of blue glass so well it looks as if it would ring out glad tidings at the lightest blow of a fingernail. A thick rime of frost everywhere, giving things a festive tinsel trim. The rare northern sunlight makes up in brilliance for what it lacks in warmth, like certain nervous temperaments. Today the stars and stripes billow out bravely, as if they meant it, above the courtyard of the Imperial Circus, where the courtyard is as full of folk and bustle as a broigel, all in motion, all hustle-bustle. Amid laughter, horseplay, and snatches of song, rosy-cheeked, whistling stable boys stamp their feet, blow on their fingers, dash hither and thither with bales of hay and oats on their shoulders, sacks of vegetables for the elephants, hands of bananas for the apes, or heave stomach-churning pitchforks of dung onto a stack of soiled straw. Well mittened and muffled, the little charivaris practice their familial occupation along the princess's washing line, teetering along with much hilarity, while the washing line's owner, a sack over her habitual morning déshabille to keep out the cold, oversees the unloading of a hideous cargo of bleeding meat from a knacker's van drawn by a gaunt restive hack an inch away from horseflesh itself. Noisy vendors from the town invade the colonel's peripatetic empire to hawk hot jam pies and kvass from wheeled barrels. A lugubrious gypsy strays into the courtyard to add the wailing of his fiddle to the clatter of boot heels on cobbles, the babel of tongues, the perpetual soft jangle as the elephants within the building agitate their chains. The sound that reminds the colonel, always with a shock of pleasure, of the outrageous daring of his entire enterprise.
Tuskers across the tundra!
For Colonel Carney, up betimes, presides over the carnival-like proceedings. How he loves hurry-scurry, loves it purely, loves it passionately, for its own sake. He feels about bustle, like Russians feel about sloth. He sticks his fingers in either pocket of the starry waistcoat, then swells as if his paunch were pregnant with profit, as he struts about on his bandy little legs in their striped trousers, bright and twisty as candy sticks. He has just shone up his dollar sign belt buckle. He is the living image of the entrepreneur. He dodges back and forth amongst his employees as they fly about their business, fending off the native salespersons with quick flips of the elbow under which Sybil, squealing intelligently, has been stowed, a moving cloud of blue cigar smoke round his head and an affable and optimistic smile on his well-satisfied visage as he tosses a cheery word to one and all. That morning, the newspapers carry an anonymous letter which claims that Feathers is not a woman at all, but a cunningly constructed automaton made up of whalebone, india rubber, and springs. The colonel beams with pleasure at the consternation this ploy will provoke, at the way the box office tills will clang in the delicious rising tide of rumour. Is she fiction or is she fact? His motto is,
"The bigger the humbug, the better the public likes it. That's the way to play the ludic game, with no holes barred."
Another motto, in one word,
"Bamboozle'em. Play the game to win, yes sir."
He plots a news item tomorrow, inserted in the foreign news by his contacts. This, contradicting the vicious clockwork rumour, will proclaim that Feathers, all woman as she is, back home in England, secretly engaged to the Prince of Wales.
Yes, sirree!
The apes had already emptied their chamber pots onto the dung heap and rinsed them out under the pump. Back in their quarters, they swept up, laid down fresh straw, and made up their bunk beds. They composed themselves in silent groups, heads bent over books. Now and then, one would gesticulate in that measured, urgent fashion of theirs, and another would nod, or shake its well-brushed head, or answer with a little dance of fingers. Monsieur Lamarque, the ape-man, was nowhere to be seen, slumped in drunken slumber on the sawdust of a low bar. A casual observer might have thought the apes, dedicated little troopers or well-programmed organisms that they were, could not leave off their act for even one moment, and now were rehearsing for the apes at school routine. In fact, it was their dedication to self-improvement that was boundless. Even the absence of Mignon, for whom they felt disinterested pity, did not interfere with their studies. The female with the green ribbon spared a thought for the wounded clown, however. If all was quiet on the monkey front, fearful sounds erupted from the cages of the cats as they prowled their confined space. The tigers roared, first one, then another, then all at once. Where is our breakfast? We never got delicious clown yesterday. Now we want our beef, our horseflesh, our legs and ribs of goat. When she heard their imperatives rise above the clamour, the princess filled her arms with bleeding meat. The Princess of Abyssinia,
had never visited, even on business, the country whose royal title she usurped, nor did she come from any other part of Africa. Her mother, a native of Guadeloupe in the Windward Islands, taught the piano for a living, until she upped and ran away with a man who visited her sleepy town with a travelling fair. This man kept a mangy, toothless lion in a cage for a sideshow, and called himself an Ethiopian, although he hailed in fact from Rio de Janeiro. The impetus of their elopement took them as far as Marseille, where their daughter was born. Her parents were devoted to each other. Her mother sat in the cage and played Mozart sonatas. They prospered. Her father crowned himself king and went into tigers. If tigers are not native to the Horn of Africa, then neither was he. When her parents died, the princess inherited piano and cats. She polished the act to its present splendour. So much for her history, which was only mysterious in that she told it to nobody, because she never spoke. In the ring, she looked like a member of the graduating class at a provincial conservatoire, in a white frock with starched flounces, white cotton stockings, flat, strapped shoes of the kind called Mary Jane's, and a butterfly bow of white satin in the crisp hair that stuck out halfway down her back. In this garb, she played the piano, and the tigers danced. At the beginning of the act, the cats bounced into the ring, roaring to illustrate their own ferocity, while the grooms ran round the caged arena, firing off blank shots from guns. She came after, in her good girl's dress, and sat down at the Bechstein Grand. This was the only time, as she seated herself with her back towards them, that she felt lonely, uneasy. At the first chords, the cats, whom she could not see, leapt onto the semicircle of pedestals placed ready for them, and sat there on their haunches, panting, pleased with themselves for their obedience. And then it would come to them, always with a fresh surprise, no matter how often they performed, that they did not obey in freedom, but had exchanged one cage for a larger cage. Then, for just one unprotected minute, they pondered the mystery of their obedience, and were astonished by it. Just for that moment, while she knew they wondered what on earth they were doing there, when her vulnerable back was turned towards them, and her speaking eyes away from them, the princess felt a little scared, and perhaps more fully human than she was used to feeling. Sometimes then, she thought how much she'd like an accomplice, somebody else in the ring with her. Not a stable boy, not a groom, but somebody she trusted. Somebody who could keep an eye on the cats during that tense moment when she played the invitation to the waltz, while she asked herself if today, of all days, this might be the day when they decided they would not take up her invitation. Whether tonight of all nights of their mutual treaty, the cats would not, one by one, succumb to the music and come down to choose their partners, but would... She always kept a gun on top of the piano, just in case, and this gun was not loaded with blanks. Nevertheless, she lived in the closest intimacy with her cats, nesting beside their cages in a bale of clean straw. She washed their eyes with boric acid and argyrol to prevent infection. She rubbed their tender feet with ointment for them. But she never smiled at her cats, because theirs was not a friendly pact. It existed in order to prevent hostilities, not to promote amity. And, "Cat got your tongue?" you might have said to the princess, because early in her career she discovered how they grumbled at the back of their throats and laid their ears flat when she used that medium of human speech which nature denied them. It was rumoured she was herself a tigress's foster child, abandoned in the jungle and suckled by wild bears. But there is no jungle near Marseille. Since she said nothing, she never denied these stories. The colonel spread them freely. On the rare random occasions when she took some other human back to her bed in the straw, beside the sleeping tigers, she always made love in the dark, because her body was, every inch, scarred with claw marks, as if tattooed. That was the price they made her pay for taming them. Now,
The crackling perfume of frying sausages and bacon mingles with heavy odours of dung, meat, pastry, and wild beasts in the courtyard. The cookhouse, a stove, a counter, has opened up, and is, heaven be praised, cried the stable lads, serving honest English breakfasts. When Samson, the strong man, brushing aside the Russian peddlers with a xenophobic oath, came to get his morning mug and doorstep, he suffered a deal of joshing from the roustabouts munching their bacon sandwiches to have lost, according to the swiftly disseminated gossip of the circus, his inamorata to a clown. Samson never once let on he'd left Mignon to the mercies of the escaped tiger, and that was when the clown stepped in. Far from it. He boasted, flexing his gleaming pecs, of what he'd do to that bastard clown when he got his hands on him. And indeed, his pride was genuinely piqued, because Mignon had run off to Clown Alley, after her saviour. In all this, Mignon assumed a woman's place, that of the cause of discord between men. How else to these men could she play any real part in their lives? The colonel doffs his billycock hat with delighted glee, as feathers, looking not in the least like India rubber, but very much flesh for the Prince of Wales, that connoisseur, stumps past. She is as ugly a walker as an unhorsed Valkyrie, but her amazing curves promise delights of which the colonel often dreams. Lizzie, humping her handbag, which could look like that of a midwife or of an abortionist, hurled the colonel a black look from some unguessable depths of Sicilian malice. For himself, the colonel regarded the chaperone as the stumbling block between himself and an intimate dîner à deux with the air réaliste, which might lead, who knows to what?
Yes, sir!
He burst out with a veritable plume of smoke at the thought, crushing Sybil to him in his enthusiasm so vigorously that she shrieked. Lizzie paused to toss the gypsy fiddler a kopeck, receiving in return a burst of incomprehensible gratitude, and for some reason a tract or ballad sheet of some kind, which she stowed away in her handbag without a glance. The colonel thought no more of it, although the hot jam pie vendor, in reality a member of the secret police, would have been curious to see the transaction. But Feathers chose just that moment to disencumber him of his entire stock and lavishly distribute them among the Charivari children, who came tumbling off the washing line for the treat, jumping about the pieman with such Latin enthusiasm he could scarcely see to take the money. The two women had some girl with them, or rather, a young lady, fair-haired, slim, nattily turned out in red wool. She impressed the colonel only with a vague familiarity.
"Ain't I seen that somewhere before?"
And she made no impression at all on the strong man, so engrossed was he in describing to his friends the injuries Walser would suffer when they met again. The colonel chewed his cigar and sighed, because Feathers gave him only the brusquest nod as the two females with their guest disappeared into the menagerie, as if hot on the track of the bloody spoor the princess had left behind her. The colonel's admiration for Feathers grew in direct ratio to her indifference and the advance bookings. But,
"Hi there! Hi, hi, hi!"
his easily distracted attention fixed on the tumultuous entry of the clowns and their pack of yapping dogs. His own recruit, he noted happily, was present and correct, if looking a little worse for wear, arm in a sling and all.
"Now's your chance," said the guffawing stable boys to Samson.
But Samson took one look at Buffo, big as a house and already half seas over, shepherding his flock into the circus with his customary deranged majesty and the air of one about to commit grievous bodily harm.
"Not off,"
opined the strong man, judging discretion the better part. He shoved his mug back on the counter and buggered off.
"Catch him when he's on his tilt."
Buffo, leading the clowns, the dozen clowns. Hold hard, what's this? A baker's dozen clowns? Where yesterday had been 12, today there were 13, and the 13th distinctly on the small side. The clowns. See them as a band of terrorists? No, that's not right. Not terrorists, but irregulars. A band of irregulars,
permitted the most ferocious piracies as long as, just so long as, they maintained the bizarrerie of their appearance, so that their violent exposition of manners stays on the safe side of terror, even if we need to learn to laugh at them. And part at least of this laughter comes from the successful suppression of fear. Little Ivan's relations with the clowns went thus. First, he was afraid of them. Then, he was entranced by them. At last, he wished to become as they, so that he, too, could terrify, enchant, vandalize, ravage, yet always stay on the safe side of being, licensed to commit license, and yet forbidden to act, so that the babushka back at home could go on reddening and blackening the charcoal, even if the clowns detonated the entire city around her, and nothing would really change. Nothing. The exploded buildings would float up into the air, insubstantial as bubbles, and gently waft to earth again, on exactly the same places where they had stood before. The corpses would writhe, spring apart at the joints, dismember, then pick up their own dismembered limbs to juggle with them before slotting them back in their good old sockets, all present and correct, sir. So then you'd know, you'd seen the proof, that things would always be as they had always been, that nothing came of catastrophe, that chaos invoked stasis. It was as though a fairy godmother had given each clown an ambivalent blessing when he was born. You can do anything you like, as long as nobody takes you seriously. Buffo sewed bells on a three-cornered cap for his newest apprentice, so that he won't hear the trickle as his brains run out. Little Ivan, in cap and bells, somersaulted round the ring as if emancipated altogether from the bipedal posture, until he bumped into Buffo, somersaulting round the ring in the other direction. Then he got a thrashing for getting in the way, and for at least 5 minutes thought better of running away with the circus. But though he sat sulking in the front row with his thumb in his mouth, still, he could not take his eyes off the comedians. Buffo thought up a routine, especially for Walser, since he could no longer stand on his hands. Crow like a cock.
Cock-a-doodle-doo, said Walser, obediently.
Cock-a-doodle-dooski, amended Buffo, as a little tribute to the czar of all the rushes. Flap your arms about a bit.
Cock-a-doodle-dooski.
Entering into the spirit of the thing, Walser rose up on his toes and kneaded the air with his arms as best he could with one in a sling.
"Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls," intoned Buffo, "I give him, and you can take him, the human chicken!"
Grick found an egg, not too fresh, inside his fiddle, and tossed it between Walser's eyes. Buffo creaked approval. Grock found a couple of eggs in the belly of his tambourine. Amid ululations of glee, all the clowns followed suit, whipping eggs out of various parts of their clothing and anatomies, and pelted Walser until egg liquor streamed down his face, blinding him. Grick and Grock struck up "A Hunting We Will Go" on their various instruments. Little Ivan thought how many pancakes his granny could have made with all those eggs that now spattered the sawdust, but he did not think so for long, because he was laughing too much to think. Walser's invisible tormentors whisked their satin coattails out of his reach as he lunged at them, tripped him up with their long shoes, shoved out their stilts to bring him down. When he heard little Ivan's peals of merriment, his anger rose.
"What the hell's so funny about this?"
And he lashed out, he knew not where. They told him afterwards that his balked gestures of fury were the funniest thing as they drove him round the ring with blows and mocking cries. His balked gestures of fury and his comic wound. Henceforward, Walser will wear a coxcomb, and Buffo, after a little thought, massaging his great white lantern jaw, decided that, with his coxcomb and his crowing, the human chicken should forthwith feature on the menu at the clown's Christmas dinner. Walser's new profession was beginning to make demands on him. Meanwhile, Feathers, in the menagerie, maintained an animated, if one-sided, conversation with the princess in raw French.
"Quel chanteuse," she said. "Quel spectacle!"
The princess, in her bloody apron, opened a panel in the cage and tossed in half a butcher's shop. The tigers fell on the feast, snarling and cuffing one another about the ears in their greed. As she watched them, the princess's dark face was that of Kali, and the perfume round her, dense enough, rank and pervasive enough, to act as an invisible barrier between herself and all those who were not furred. Fevers knew she was a tough customer. She was undaunted.
"Elle s'appelle Mignon. C'est vachement chouette, ça?"
Mignon leaned against Fevers' shoulder, vaguely gazing at motes of dust in the light, unaware she was the subject of all this. If her new maroon dress with the quasi-military froggings reminded you a little of the uniform of the doorman at the Hôtel de l'Europe, that was just what, until 6 o'clock that morning, it had been.
"Just a stitch here and there, and it'll fit her perfect. You don't mind, do you, old chum?"
Lizzie had done her yellow hair in twisted braids round her head. She looked like a minister's daughter, not a murderer's whelp. The princess gave Fevers a quizzical, interrogative look, and tapped her own mouth. Fevers understood.
"To sing is not to speak," said Fevers, her syntax subtler than her pronunciation. "If they hate speech because it divides us from them, to sing is to rob speech of its function and render it divine. Singing is to speech what dancing is to walking. You know they love to dance. Cross fingers and hope for luck," she added to herself.
The princess's charges yawned and stretched. She took off her apron. She looked Mignon up and down. They were just the same height. Both little things. Frail. One as fair as the other was dark. Twinned opposites. And both possessed that quality of exile, of apartness from us, although the princess had chosen her exile amongst the beasts, while Mignon's exile had been thrust upon her. Perhaps it was that homeless look of Mignon's that made up the princess's mind for her. She nodded. The replete cats lay with their heavy heads between their paws among the bloody bones, a beautiful still life, or nature morte, of orange tawny shapes, composed around the princess's open Bechstein grand. They drowsed like unawakened desire, like unlit fire, a tangerine cub curled for a nap on the piano stool. Mignon realized for the first time the plans the grown-ups had laid for her, and when the princess stepped into the cage, she hung back, clinging to Fevers' hand and mewing faintly with alarm. But Fevers, beaming encouragement, hugged her, scooped her up bodily, and deposited her within, closing the door behind her sharply. The princess motioned Mignon to a position beside the piano, from whence she could outstare the cats. But the cats, enjoying their post-prandial snooze, registered Mignon's presence by only the faintest twitching of nostrils and whisker. The princess patted the rifle on the piano top. That consoled Mignon somewhat. The princess set the sleeping cub among the straw and took its place. She softly fingered the keys, as if the piano might suggest appropriate music of its own accord. Mignon stuck close to the piano, but soon grew so enchanted at the sight of the princess's black fingers on the white keys that she forgot to be afraid. Fevers, watching intently, absently, stripped off her kid glove so that she could bite her nails. Lizzie, squatting on her handbag, muttered rapidly to herself in some language that was not quite Italian. When the piano told the princess what she should play, she pushed her hair back behind her ears with a bravura gesture and attacked the keyboard in earnest. Mignon started in recognition. Do not think the English schoolboy whom her husband murdered omitted to teach Mignon the song that was written for her before she was born. How could he have resisted it, once he learned her name? He hesitated deliciously between Liszt's setting and Schubert's. However odd the accompaniment sounded on his wheezing harmonica, he made sure Mignon knew her own song, although she did not understand the words, even though They were in her own language. To speak is one thing. To sing is quite another. Here and there among the cats, an eyelid flickered. Almost as if she awed herself at her daring, Mignon's voice quavered as she asked them if they knew that land. The cats stirred in the straw.
No, no, it's too early in the morning.
Do you know the land where the lemon trees grow?
Oh, let us sleep a little longer. We've only just eaten.
Do you know that land where the lemon trees grow?
Implored Mignon, as she saw their eyes open, their eyes like precious fruit. They stirred and rustled, for might not this land be the Eden of our first beginnings, where innocent beasts and wise children play together under the lovely lemon trees? The tiger abnegates its ferocity, the child her cunning.
Is it? Is it?
The cats all lifted their huge heads, and their eyes dropped amber tears, as if for their own dumb fates. Slowly, slowly, all the beasts dragged themselves towards the source of music, softly beating their tails against the straw. At the end of the first verse, a soft, ecstatic purring rose up from them all, until the entire menagerie sounded like the interior of a huge hive of bees.
And then there are the mountains.
As Mignon's voice, at first a little uncertain, gathered certainty and strength and floated through the menagerie, the apes looked up from their books with unanswerable questions in their eyes. Even the clowns grew still and hushed. The elephants, for just as long as the song lasted, ceased to rattle their chains. The princess knew the problem of the pause of terror was solved. When the song was over, the tranced cats sighed and shifted a little on their haunches, but the cue for the dance never came. The princess was kissing Mignon. Feathers and Lizzie let out great breaths of relief, and likewise kissed each other.
The cruel sex threw her away like a soiled glove, said Feathers. And us girls have gone and sent her to the cleaners, Lizzie concluded triumphantly.
That appeared to conclude the hiring. The princess made Mignon curtsy to the cats. The girls came out of the cage hand in hand. The cats dropped back their noses on their paws. The princess kissed Feathers on both cheeks in thanks.
A real class act, congratulated Feathers.
They left them, commencing to rehearse the waltz. And now the courtyard had emptied itself like an unplugged bath, its morning business done. The colonel was gone to the box office to check the till. The cookhouse counter shuttered up, roustabouts and stable boys off to the odorous warmth of the menagerie to play cards and imbibe vodka. The little charivaris, seized with dreadful stomach pains from gobbling down the secret policeman's pies, were tucked up in their bunks with hot water bottles on their bellies. Mama blamed Feathers. In the deserted silence, the birds returned to peck at the refuse, and there was a young man in comedy suspenders stooping to sluice his face under the water pump as well as he could with one arm.
"It's your beau," said Lizzie without pleasure. "It's Hank the Yank, the reporter, Johnny."
Feathers advanced upon Walter from behind, and judging her moment, slapped her hands over his eyes as soon as his face emerged from the stream of water.
"Boo!"
Unaccustomed to love, he diagnosed the effects of a sleepless night, when his heart banged at the sight of her. She eyed him with reluctant speculation, swaying back and forth on high heels that gave her a couple of inches advantage over him in height, an advantage she enjoyed.
"How's the wonky arm?" she inquired.
He showed his sling.
"You take care of it. Scratch of a tiger. Confess to something rotten, that can."
She dropped her voice a couple of decibels, until it sounded lubricious.
"I hear," she said. "You walked out on death warmed up last night, after all that. Seems like I got it wrong, love. Seems like you weren't knocking her off after all."
Walser hid his face,
polishing away the last of the egg stains with his sleeve. Feathers giggled and struck him lightly with her gloves. The moodiness of the previous night quite gone, replaced by a mysterious coquettishness.
"I must say, Mr. Walser," she added in a provocative tone, "it's very flattering you should pursue me thus, to the ends of the earth, you might say. Eh?"
Before Walser could reply, Lizzie, as if she could wait no longer for this courtship ritual to reach its consummation, tugged impatiently at the sleeve of his good arm. "Oh, Mr. Walser, there's a question of some letters home. We, that is Feathers and me, was just wondering whether, oh, you're not dispatching at the moment due to your wound? Well then, all the more room for our stuff." From her enormous handbag, she withdrew a cornucopia of papers and thrust them at him. Chapter 8. Since the star had not worked circuses before, there was a good deal of animosity towards her in the company, especially amongst the Charivaris, high-wire dancers themselves for centuries, who were engaged in the same debate with gravity as she, except that she was cheating. They were sure of it. They knew it in their bones they needed no proof, and the cheat had nudged them out of their customary place at the top of the bill with the aid of mechanical contrivances. They even held a little to the gutta-percha theory concerning Feather's anatomy. That very morning, over breakfast, coffee and milk, the children suggested perhaps there was some way she might be dropped from heaven, to see if she would bounce. Mama remonstrated, "Naughty, naughty." But she and Papa exchanged thoughtful looks. When Feathers turned the children's stomachs with her gifts of poisoned pies, it was the last straw. They resentfully arrived to witness Feathers' band rehearsal, dozen upon dozen of them, Papa, Mama, brothers, sisters, cousins. They possessed in full measure that Italian knack of making a crowd, so the Charivaris en masse seemed far more than the sum of their parts, even without the little children, who stayed home in their bunks, groaning. As if by right, the Charivaris occupied the imperial box, for the family had entertained every European emperor of note since Nero. Indeed, they felt themselves to be a vital part of circus history, and it was at such a rich tradition they thought that Feathers thumbed her nose. All bore fixed expressions of hostility and contempt upon their faces. Little people, delicately made but wiry, in leotards. The women left curling rags in their hair in order to show contempt. It is a phenomenon of the trapeze that its practitioners always look larger upon it than they are in life. Little and live is, therefore, the rule for the air, as it is, as the Charivaris knew well, for the wire. A big flyer looks a clumsy flyer, no matter how great the art. The ideal female flyer turns the scale at, say, 100 pounds, and stands no higher in her slippers than 5'2". Her male partner might give her perhaps 10 more pounds and 3 more inches, but still he will be a small man on the ground, though he might look like a Greek god as he hurtles through the air at those speeds of theirs in excess of 60 miles an hour. Feathers, remember, was 6'2" in her stockinged feet, and turned the scale at 14 English stone. God, she looked huge! Her crimson-purple wings in flight obscured the roof-tree of the Imperial Circus. Yet those marmoreal, immense arms and legs of hers, as they made leisurely swimming movements through the air, looked palely unconvincing, as if arbitrarily tacked on to the bird attire. Walser, drawn to the ring like a moth to a flame, thought as he had before, "She looks wonderful, but she doesn't look right." Yet he could not put his finger on what was wrong, could not identify in quite what way the proportions seemed distorted, since there existed no correct proportions to compare hers with. Or was the trouble this? There was an air about her that suggested, whilst convincing others, she herself remained unconvinced about the precise nature of her own illusion. The slowness of her trajectory, her modest chug at 25 miles per hour, was the whole trick. It made the Charivaris huff.
With her right hand, she caught hold of the rung of the trapeze. There was a clean, twanging snap. A rope broke. The colonel, watching her now in besotted terror, as a moment before he'd gazed in besotted ecstasy, had judged it a publicity coup to use not hack musicians, but the cream of the Petersburg Conservatoire for the pit band at this booking. The snag was, these long hairs did not know the first rule of the spectacle, that the show must go on. And now the Ride of the Valkyries, superbly played, broke down on an aghast discord as the trapeze dropped feathers a dozen feet and left her swinging to and fro like a pendulum above the tiny eye of sawdust, the vortex of gravity, down there, down below. Her wings quivered, and the little feathers round the edges nervously whipped the air. But she showed no fear, even if she felt it. She twisted round, and with her free hand, waved, or as they say in the circus, styled, at the imperial box, in an ironic gesture. She even poked out her tongue. Musicians, horns and fiddles dangling from their hands, the colonel, waltzer, watched, helpless, hearts in mouths, for an endless minute. The charivaris on edge watched. Only in her own good time did she agitate her pendulum. She swung upon it, faster and faster, and when she gained enough momentum, only then did she let go, and launched herself off again, to arrive at the other side of the big top, where she landed upon her other trapeze, abruptly sat, briskly furled, folded her arms like a furious washerwoman, and vast, immobile, sulking, ignored the commotion that broke out below. A confused murmur issued from the imperial box, in which sound it was possible to discern disappointment.
"Bastards!"
cried Lizzie, and repeated and augmented her abuse in several dialects of Italian. The charivaris energetically fired back. The colonel lit a fresh cigar and appeared to be imploring his pig for advice. Aloft, feathers hunched in a pet.
"No, she won't come down. She's safer up here, ain't she? Why did no one test the rope? What murderous fuckers have been tinkering with the rig?"
High as she was, you could hear every word. A roustabout discovered the rope which snapped had been neatly sawn half through. A plot. Suspicion instantly falls upon the charivaris. The charivaris expostulate tumultuously, rising up and running back and forth along the ledges of the boxes. Lizzie hurls a torrent of quick, angry speech at the colonel, while the gesticulating charivaris put forward whatever cases of their own they feel might hold water. The colonel champs at his cigar and tickles his pig's ears, and knows in his heart, when Sybil squeals and nods, there will be nothing for it but to send the charivaris packing. Give them a bonus on top of their unearned pay, strike them off the bill, send them back to Milan on the next train. Either that, or he loses feathers, which is not to be imagined, especially since feathers has consented to dine with him that night, on condition he auditions Mignon. Not, of course, that this will be the last of it, as far as the charivaris are concerned. For the rest of their professional careers, the entire family will suffer from foot rot, boils on the bum, headaches, indigestion, all the small, irritating, painful ailments that poison life for you, but do you no lasting harm, that don't kill you off but keep you permanently off colour. Nothing in itself bad enough to keep any one of them from the high wire. Only henceforth, upon it, all will perform less well. Off form. Their collective destiny is always to be off form. The children who wanted to see if feathers bounced will never quite recover from the secret policeman's pies. They will suffer the fate of never equaling their parents, even when those parents are off form. In the future, if ever Lizzie so much as thinks of the charivaris, one or other of the clan will suffer an undiagnosable twinge. The historic tribe, who rope danced before Nero, Charlemagne, the Borgias, Napoleon, the charivaris, will now enter a long, slow eclipse. Finally forced to emigrate, 2 millennia of circus art will peter out in a pizza concession on Mott Street. Good night.
When the colonel reluctantly consented to sack the Charivaris, Feathers came down to earth again, although she did not jump, as she jumped down at the Alhambra, but like any other trapeze artiste, used the rope ladder provided. Her grumblings grew louder as she approached terra firma. Walser, half laughing, half wondering, almost, yet not quite, convinced himself the woman had been in no more danger than a parrot might be if she pushed it off its perch. And though he was altogether unwilling to believe this might be so, still he was enchanted by the paradox. If she were indeed a lusus naturi, a prodigy, then she was no longer a wonder. She would no longer be an extraordinary woman, no more the greatest aerialiste in the world, but a freak. Marvellous indeed, but a marvellous monster, an exemplary being denied the human privilege of flesh and blood, always the object of the observer, never the subject of sympathy, an alien creature, forever estranged. "She owes it to herself to remain a woman," he thought. "It is her human duty. As a symbolic woman, she has a meaning. As an anomaly, none. As an anomaly, she would become again, as she once had been, an exhibit in a museum of curiosities. But what would she become if she continued to be a woman? Then he saw she was pale under her rouge, as if recovering from real fear, and bundling herself in her feathery cape, as if it would warm her. She gave him a thin smile. "Nearly came unstuck, eh?" she said ambiguously. Lizzie ran to her with half a bottle of brandy from the bar. The colonel hovered, uttering flattering sweet words, but Feathers, subsiding into a ringside seat, shushed him silent as an iron clanking heralded the erection of the enormous cage in which the princess and her cats performed.
"My protégé," said Feathers, gulping brandy. "Now you'll see something."
Walser tried to sit down beside her, but Lizzie firmly pushed him out of the way, so he sat down beside the colonel instead. Preoccupied with Mignon's debut, the princess had spared no thought for herself, forgotten to so much as pop on a frock, and both her petticoat and chemise could have done with a wash, hem of one stained with excrement of the cages, and the waist of the other with bloody prints from absent-minded wipings of her hands. But as for Mignon, what fairy godmother had touched the little street waif with her wand? Her flaxen hair was piled up in soft curls and secured with a pink satin rose. A regular ball gown, white as icing, all romantic frills and lace, was cut in a way that showed how well her bruises were healing. She thrust out her meagre bosom, as if to let a caged bird within it free. Only by the second verse, the colonel began to rustle a little.
"Leader in the tiger cage," he brooded aloud. "Tasser, real class act, yes, sir. That mightn't be too high class. Get my meaning, wasted on the hoi polloi, mightn't..."
"Shush,"
remonstrated Feathers sharply. Walser's eyes prickled, and that vertiginous sensation he by now associated with the presence of the aerialiste overwhelmed him, although he knew, this time, the music was as much to blame as she. A scatter of applause from the little audience, modified by an aggressive silence from Sybil, that justified somewhat the colonel's apprehensions, for he held great store by his pig's commercial acumen.
"Nope, not for this show, not that song."
There was cash to be coined from the singer, but not if she and her accompanist persisted in turning the ring into a concert hall. He strove to recall how his great predecessor Barnum marketed Jenny Lind, the Swedish nightingale, for the great American public.
"Sign up Mignon? Yes, but sign her up with this cat act? Problems." "What else?" he rasped, champing his butt. "Can you do?"
Mignon, manipulating her romantic skirts with marvellous dexterity, approached the biggest tiger on his pedestal and curtsied.
"The ladies excuse me."
The tiger's tail twitched, and the tunnels of his nostrils tingled in response to the tasty civet in her perfume. The princess gave out the preliminary chord. Down he jumped from his perch. The princess,
out of respect for the city, chose to play the Grand Waltz from Onegin. 1, 2, 3. Mignon waltzed with the tiger. 1, 2, 3. The tall beast, a little stiff and grandfatherly, tenderly bent over the debutante, fully 6 feet tall on his hind legs, and, it would seem, somewhat discommoded by the leather gauntlet secured to his forepaws with string, lest in the excitement of the moment he let out his retracted claws with disastrous consequences to Mignon's bare shoulders, which had only the appearance of marble. Round and round they went, Mignon humming along the tune in an absent-minded and saucillating voice, as pleased with herself and the effect she made as any girl at her first ball. But the tiger's bride was sad to be cut out, and perhaps even jealous at losing her partner to the pretty girl. Putting back her ears, she began to growl a sulphurous undermusic. Hand in the tiger's paw, Mignon styled to the crowd, as the princess taught her, then curtsied to the tiger, to the other dancers, beaming with her customary lack of discrimination, for it was all in the day's work to her, pretending to be dead, or dancing with a fearful living. More applause, far more than hitherto, because every single one of the educated apes crept in to perch along the upper benches. Few of the non-simian habitués of the imperial circus could have behaved with more decorum as they clapped to see their former keeper in her new incarnation. One of them, with a green hair ribbon, caught Walter's eye and winked at him. The ape man was, as usual, elsewhere, nailed to some low bar by liquor, no doubt. This time, Sybil could barely contain her enthusiasm, and the colonel's doubts vanished. He was quite consoled for the loss of the Cherivaris.
"That beats all, don't it, Sybil? What nerve, what class, what an attraction! If that little blondie ain't a wonder, and as for the brown-skinned gal, why, she's just the amazing thing. Tell you what," he confided to Sybil, "what say we drop the song? Just drop it, forget it. Drop the song, go straight into the dance."
Mignon led her partner back to his pedestal and dropped a kiss on his plush forehead before courteously handling him up. But a huge amber tear dropped out of the tigress's eye, and then another. The princess tapped her teeth with her fingernail when she saw those disappointed tears, and beckoned impatiently at the observers. Walser felt a nudging at his bad arm, and looking down, saw that Sybil was poking him with her snout.
"Don't you see, man?" interpreted the colonel in a julep-haunted whisper. "The princess wants a volunteer. Sybil knows. Sybil can tell. Off you go, young fella, and do your duty. Do your duty by the looted game and Colonel Carney's circus."
"Here, Mr. Colonel," said Feathers. "I say, ain't that a bit much?"
The princess beckoned again. Sybil nudged again, this time ferociously.
"Ain't you an American?" implored the colonel. "Where's your spirit?"
"But that's the cat tried to eat me," cried Walser, aghast.
"So, you've been introduced already? Fine."
"But my arm. He's a wounded soldier, poor sod."
Walser looked from side to wide, seeking escape, but saw instead the apparition of the strong man come to gawp at Mignon. A vision of gleaming muscle, the strong man saw Walser at the same moment. His biceps rose, as if reflexively. Feathers covered her eyes with one hand and raised the brandy bottle to her lips with the other.
"Walser by name, I may be, ma'am, but I fear I'm no dancing man,"
apologized Walser to his auburn partner. But the lovely creature, with a relief of the reprieved wallflower, laid her head on his injured shoulder with a gentle, reassuring pressure, and it was just as well she was in an appeasing mood, since there was no time to procure her gloves. She led. She steered Walser round the ring with complete assurance and a wonderfully grave concern.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Mignon whirled by, flashed the clown a brilliant smile, and Walser, supported by the unforged steel of the tigress's forepaws, thought, "There goes beauty and the beast." Then looking into the tigress's depthless jeweled eyes, he saw reflected there the entire alien essence of a world of fur, sinew and grace, in which he was the clumsy interloper, and as the tigress steered his bedazzlement once more round the